President Trump says he will actually consider using Tomahawk missiles, or rather allowing the Ukraine side to use Tomahawk missiles against Russia if President Putin doesn't do as he's told and reaches a negotiated settlement on terms beneficial to the Kiev regime. I'm not sure how well that's going to play, but that's actually what President Trump said. And we're going to get into all that and all the ramifications of what's going on and what and some other meetings that are happening in Europe even today on this very topic with one of our favorite guests, Colonel Jacques Beau, former member of the Swiss Strategic Intelligence Service and a former NATO officer and author of many books on a lot of these issues here. And one of the reasons we love to go to you, Colonel, welcome back to the show as always.
Thank you for having me back in your show. Thank you.
Well, listen, a lot of people have been talking about this whole Tomahawk issue for a while, and it's been very clearly articulated that these things can only be used if you have either like American bombers, American missile submarines, or a hard launch site that we only have a couple of, some Neptune missiles, I think is what their launch systems is what they're called. So that's not a missile you can just hand over to Ukraine. That's kind of the first issue here. And even Russia has acknowledged these can only be fired with the direct participation of the Americans. And so the idea was that this is a potential serious escalatory issue. Even before we get into, actually, no, just to kind of to set the stage here, let me go right to what President Trump said on Air Force One just yesterday.
When did you know that Hamas was going to release the hostages?
Well, I'll tell you, I think it really started when we took out the nuclear capability.
We're looking for the one from the Air Force One. Or maybe we don't have it. We had it a minute ago. Well, we'll see if we can pull that one back up. But President Trump said, "Yeah, I'm seriously considering giving the Tomahawk missile to Ukraine if Russia doesn't if Putin doesn't agree to a term. Maybe it will, maybe it won't." He said, "But that's what he has agreed to." What is your thoughts on this whole issue of the Tomahawk missile and whether it'll be used?
Well, first of all, they want to have Tomahawks going in their direction. I don't think so. I think I might speak to Russia about that. In all fairness, I told that to President Zelensky, because Tomahawks are a new step of aggression. Right? You understand that very well.
Are
okay?
You saying that you will speak to Putin first about
then
Tomahawks?
I might talk to him. I might say, look, if this war's not going to get settled, I'm going to send them Tomahawks. I may say that. The Tomahawk is an incredible weapon, very offensive weapon. And honestly, Russia does not need that. They don't need that. Yeah, I might tell them that. If the war is not settled, that we may very well do it. We may not, but we may do it. I think it's appropriate to bring up. Yeah.
I mean, what kind of message does that even send, that I may send Tomahawks or I may not? Maybe I'll do it, but it's a very offensive weapon, an aggressive weapon. He even says it out loud.
Well, I think the way he answers is already answering your question, because we see that he has no clear idea why he would give that. It's just a leverage that he's trying to use against Russia by threatening to send Tomahawk missiles. And I'm not sure, I mean, surely that in the Pentagon they have understood what are the implications of that. But I'm not sure that Trump has understood what could be the implications. We are today, I think, in a very dangerous period, because we are in a moment where Europe, Ukraine have understood that they are cornered. They are like a wounded animal in the corner of the room. And that's the moment where they have to become very aggressive in order to escape the situation. And on the other hand, you have the U.S. And I think, despite the wording, I feel that Donald Trump is a weak person in reality. He has no clear ideas about what he wants to do. He has no strategy. He may have a clear objective of pulling the U.S. out of the conflict. And I can understand that, but there's no strategy on the way to achieve that. And that's where we have all these stop and goes and backwards and two step forward, two step backwards, and all that. And by the way, that was exactly the same thing with Iran and exactly the same thing with Palestine. So he's someone who may have good ideas, but he is not a strategist. He's essentially a businessman who has a tactical thinking, if we went to use military terms. That means that he fires when he sees the enemy, but his thinking doesn't go beyond the enemy. If you are a strategist, you know exactly why you are killing the guy before you or in front of you, and then you know that what is the next one and what is the next one. Like a chess player, he knows exactly eight moves forward. And that's exactly what he is not. So he thinks that by providing Ukraine with Tomahawks, that will make Russian to change their mind. And he hasn't got, and I think that's where the meeting in Anchorage was probably not as fruitful as I first assessed, because I had the impression that in Anchorage, Putin could explain exactly what is at stake for Russia, what Russia understands, and what Russia has as a position in the way to solve the conflict. And I expected Trump to have understood that for, and again, we can agree or not with Vladimir Putin and with Russians at large, but for them, the life of the Russians living in Ukraine is of primary importance. They consider that this is the war is existential to preserve the condition of existence of those Russians who live in Ukraine. And further, by having Ukrainian neutral, that means without any foreign troops, that means without any NATO on their soil, this has also existential implications for Russia because of the possible deployment of nuclear missiles and things like this. But the direct objective and the reason why Russian troops are fighting in Ukraine and the reason why the Russians want to keep the four regions that we have already mentioned many times, it's in order to preserve the condition of existence of those Russians which by law in Ukraine do not have the same rights as normal Ukrainian citizens. That's the point. And as long as the West doesn't understand that, then we cannot solve the problem, because we always consider that Putin is just trying to get territory. It's not about territory. It has been said many times, but a lot of expert and commentators and so on. But the problem is that in the West, we tend to measure military success by measuring square kilometers. This is not the way the Russians are doing. And this is the Russians don't care about the number of square kilometers. They want to destroy the threats against their fellow Russian today citizens, but previously they were simply for the same nation, the Russian nation, and this for that they are ready to pay the price, and they have already paid the price.
Right,
and
because let's consider that for a second. Let's go back to your chess analogy, and let's assume that the Russians do think 3, 4, 5, 6 moves ahead of time of what they want to do, and they know a pathway to what they want to do to achieve their objectives. And even if Trump is in the transactional phase, if he's thinking of a businessman as opposed to a international relations thinker, still he would have to understand, because one can only imagine that inside the White House in the Situation Room, the members of the Pentagon will tell him that this is not going to change the course of the war. It may stir up the hornet's nest. It may make them really mad, but it won't change the outcome. So he would therefore then know that that threat against Russia isn't going to cause them to come off of their base and to do what he says, meaning that then this can't achieve his objective. So then the question is, why would he even go there? What do you think?
Well, the problem is his way of doing deals. You know, I have been involved in many so-called deals at a lower level in local or regional conflict with the UN. And I was involved in mediating in some conflicts. And then the art of the mediator, when you are in a conflict, you're in the middle of two parties. And each party has its own understanding, its own view, its own objective. And the art of the mediator is to make, in a way, that both parties bring their view and their objective closer and closer and closer to each other, up to the point where both are on the same wavelength and are ready to sign an agreement. But they have both, on both sides, they have to make this intellectual and emotional travel, if you want, to adjust to the request of the other, to understand what is really at stake for me, what is not really, what can I give, what do I want to receive. And this process is exactly the process that leads to a sustainable peace deal or this kind of agreement. Now, Trump doesn't work like this. I don't know. I lived 4 years in New York, but I'm not sure I understand. But I was not doing real estate business. And my understanding is that in New York, when you do successful real estate deals, then you come to the guy and you point the gun to him and you say, well, now my offer is that. It's an offer you can't refuse. I let you think about it for a couple of seconds and you decide. And then we have a deal. And that's the way he does. He tries to have a leverage on individual and he tries to impose the solution to the other. Instead of leaving the adversary or the other party to think and to develop its own thinking in order to bring the two objectives, if you want, close to each other, he doesn't do that. He comes and he imposes its own. That's exactly what he did in Palestine. That's exactly what he tried to do with Iran. The Iranian refused, but that's exactly what he did. He comes and say, now you have to do that. Otherwise, I strike you. And that's
certainly what he said here. But I still just kind of scratch my head because even in the real estate situation, you say there where he points out you're either going to do it this way or not. He has leverage so that if the guy says no, then he can impose a penalty on him, which we've seen him do a lot in domestic politics here in this country, for example. But you have to have that leverage or that threat. It just falls on deaf ears. And I mean, just let me ask you on that point blank. What if President Trump uses or allows Ukraine to use these Tomahawk missiles? Forget about the ramifications of who fired it for the moment, but just look at the military. Will this change the dynamic so that Russia could be hurt enough that it can't achieve its objectives?
That's precisely the point. He thinks he has a leverage, and probably it will. I mean, it's certainly something that will not make the Russians happy. But the Russians have means to counter that kind of threat, and that would prompt the Russians A, to escalate their response, definitely. That would prompt the Russians to, let's say, to openly say, because they know already that the US is involved in a conflict. I mean, we know that. The French, the British, the German, the Poles, and the Americans are involved in a conflict. Technically, this is all legally even, I could say. But there is a kind of a gentleman's agreement that we don't mention it. And when we hear, for instance, what Vladimir Putin said during the Valdai conference, and so we see that he's reluctant to criticize openly Trump. But if we have then Tomahawk missiles openly and yes, openly given to Ukraine, he will not be able to be kind with Trump again. So meaning that he will have to escalate the verbal, the political dimension, but he will also be obliged to reply not to the US and reply in kind. Meaning that because then we have a real threat on issues that may, by law, according to the decree and the nuclear military doctrine and the decree that was adopted by Vladimir Putin about the nuclear doctrine, we are reaching the point where Russia would be entitled to respond with nuclear weapons. And the case that of Tomahawk given to Ukraine, I mean, Tomahawk were nuclear capable, even if they are not fitted with nuclear warhead, but that's something you never know when those missiles
are fired. Right. And actually, to that very point, this is what Dmitry Medvedev put on his Telegram channel just this morning, as a matter of fact, on that same issue. No, Gary, that's actually the one about Zelensky. We're looking for the telegram from Medvedev. He said, Trump said that if President of Russia doesn't resolve the Ukrainian conflict, it's not going to go good for him, quote. So just another one of his endless threats. It is if the peacemaker, again, using similar language you just mentioned, is talking about Tomahawks, then that statement is wrong. The delivery of those missiles would not be good for anyone. First and foremost, it will end badly for Trump himself. And then the key part, it has already been said 100 times in terms of Star Spangled Uncle Sam could understand. It's impossible to tell whether a Tomahawk carries a nuclear or conventional warhead while it's in flight. Their launch wouldn't guarantee or wouldn't originate from the Vandenberg Kiev. It would be controlled by the United States. In other words, by Trump. So how is Russia supposed to respond? Exactly. So he just leaves that unstated, but implies that there would be a response like you just mentioned here. So that seems to back up and contend exactly what you just said.
Well, that's exactly that. The new nuclear doctrine establish a provision in the case a country such as Ukraine was given a weapon, even a conventional weapon that threatens the command and control and a critical command and control installation and infrastructure in Russia. In that situation, the Russians could be entitled by their own law to respond against the U.S.
Now they could, but I mean let's walk through the ramifications of that for a second. Do you think Russia would do that at one?
I'm not sure they would.
Strikes? Yeah, I mean, what would he think it would take? Because that's a pretty big step.
This is a big step. But the problem is that by giving Tomahawk to Ukraine, you open the door to this step. That's the problem, you see? You create a situation where this step could be achieved. That's the problem. Now, whether the Russians would do it or not, this is another question. And my personal opinion is that the Russians are wise enough to avoid kind of instinctive. They are not hip shooters, you know, the Russians. And that is a situation where we can assume they will think twice before doing something like that. But they could. That means not directly on Washington, D.C., but maybe a ship somewhere or a plane on the Black Sea. I mean, there are so many intelligence planes. I mean, if you assume that those, I mean, you have those river joint and things like that, the EEC 135 and other aircraft like this that make ELINT or SIGINT intelligence, or even you can start with the RC-4 Global Hawk drone. You can start with that. That would be quite a strong signal, even if there's no human life lost. That would be a strong signal, because so far the Russians have never done that, and the Global Hawk are over the Black Sea 24 hours per day. So meaning that they could bring one of these down, and that would be quite a strong signal. They could bring down an EC 135. That could be also something. You know, you have all these options before reaching or sending an Oreshnik missile over the Pentagon. Nota bene that if they would do that, the Pentagon would not even be able to protect itself against this.
Yeah, that is a very sobering reality.
But we are not so far, and I think the Russians will not do it. But by providing Tomahawk to Ukraine, you open the door for
to the question, right? It becomes more realistic. And
exactly.
And then, every time one gets fired, then the threshold gets lower, and that's the real problem. That's not a problem, though, for Volodymyr Zelensky earlier today when he was addressing a lot of European officials, when he seemed to say, yeah, I'm cool with using Tomahawks.
Yesterday, I spoke with President Trump for the second time in 2 days. We went through details. Air defense, Patriot systems, Tomahawks, the energy equipment we need, and the need to stop partners buying Russian oil. Even if Hungarian guys claim it helps their election chances, in the long run, it undermines their country's security and Europe's. For Putin, every billion matters. You cannot be part of the free world and at the same time fund those who want to destroy it.
So let's look at that in different pieces there. Let's look, first of all, he's like saying, yeah, I want the Tomahawks and I'm talking to Trump about it, and I also need a bunch of air defense missiles. So what do you think that Ukraine would do if they actually got their hands on the controls of Tomahawk missiles?
Well, the problem is that when you give the Tomahawks, that means that Zelensky can reasonably assume that you allow them to use them freely, unless they are modified in a way they cannot reach a certain range, as it was done with the ATACMS, because Zelensky was never given the longer range ATACMS. Because Biden was afraid that precisely Zelensky could use that in the depth of the of Russia, and that would trigger a larger conflict that would lead to some escalation. Therefore, the ATACMS, as far as I know, as far as it was reported by the open media, by the way, the ATACMS provided to Zelensky are limited in range. It's something like 120 kilometers or something like that. In any case, the Tomahawk, if you give them, knowing that they have a range of 2,500 kilometers, that means that basically you are giving him a green card somehow. Not a green card, but yes. In any case, there is a responsibility in simply giving that. And Zelensky himself said that he would use that against Moscow and against the largest city of Russia. And that could be verified. I'm not sure about this. But I think he also threatened to use the Tomahawk against the Kremlin itself. Meaning that we know exactly that he wants to destroy. And in fact, you know, the Europeans would applaud to that, because they always they are aiming at a regime change, and Putin must go and things like this. So nobody would blame Zelensky in Europe for that.
That's well, in the, fact, let me ask you this question. What do you say to those in the European side, especially who are supportive of this, as you just point out, who say, listen, like according to this information in the FT over the weekend, it's open knowledge that the United States has been supplying Ukraine with intelligence and targeting data to strike deep inside Russia on their oil infrastructure, directly targeting their ability to fund their war. Gary, if you can put that headline up on that one, it came out in the FT over the weekend. And so, yeah, so they're saying U.S. has been helping Ukraine mount long-range strikes on Russian energy facilities for months in a joint effort to weaken the economy and force Putin to the table. U.S. intelligence has helped Kiev strike important Russian energy assets. So they may say, listen, this has already been happening, whether it's with long-range drones or long-range missiles. I mean, the U.S. has already been active, and Russia hasn't done anything. So they wouldn't do anything if it was a Tomahawk either. What do you say to that argument?
Well, it's slightly different. As I said before, the U.S. is clearly involved in this conflict. I mean, actively involved. And I think what the Financial Times published is, I wouldn't say it's open knowledge because it is more precise in the article, but we knew that. I mean, all of us understood that something like this was already happening. We had no proof and no, we could not document it, but I think it was more or less clear that it was done so. And we also know that this task force Dragon in Wiesbaden in Germany was also providing targeting data to Ukraine for the Ukrainian theater. So we know that already, but at that time it was more about battlefield intelligence and for the use, even in the depth of Russia, for the use of, let's say, Ukrainian drones. Now the things is slightly different because we provide not only the data, I mean the targeting data, but also the tool to. In fact, we are doing everything, and probably even the expert or the people who enter the data into the Tomahawk, into before the launch. So meaning that the whole chain of supply is done by the West, and what the Ukraine do is simply to shoot the missile or to launch the missile. That's all. Yeah. Meaning all the rest is then done by Westerners, or U.S. or whoever. Meaning that the responsibility we have increases dramatically. That's the first point. But there is also something that we need to understand is that by doing so and by being the U.S. in particular in that case, being on the front line, it becomes also on the front line all over the world, not just on the Ukrainian theater. We talk about the Black Sea, but if you reach the depth of the Russian territory, the whole of the U.S. presence. Think about what's happening, for instance, in Syria, the American forces in Syria or in other places in the world that could be within the range of tactical missiles or some other cruise missiles that could be fired by anyone. If something happens to the contingent in El Tanf, in Syria, probably even the U.S. could have a hard time to define who shot or who launched the missile or who launched the, So meaning that there is a providing weapons to Ukraine starts to potential for escalation, which is dramatic. For the Europeans, they are happy about this because the Europeans, that would mean that the U.S. would be involved. And that's the reason why they accept that. Because for them, what is the whole issue about all the drones that we have seen in Denmark, Norway, Sweden, elsewhere in Europe, there were probably individuals who used those drones, but I'm convinced this was not something done by Ukrainians. It was done by private people, ignoring the law and things like this. But this was used as, as a propaganda, if you want, to justify more defense spending, more military presence, more deployment on the border with Russia, and used also as an argument for the Europeans to ask for more U.S. presence in Europe. Because as Kaya Kallas said, Europe cannot help Ukraine on its own. It needs to have the U.S. And there are other aspects that Europe is no longer able to do for its own purposes, which is air defense. Meaning that had we a dramatic escalation of the situation in Europe, and that's where you see that people are short-sighted because they are ready to sacrifice Ukraine completely, I mean, for the sake of having more U.S. in Europe. Because that, at the end of the day, that's exactly what the Europeans are asking. That the whole issue about everything, all the so-called provocation we have, aim at keeping the U.S. in Europe.
Yeah. And it looks like that's starting to, there's at least evidence that that's starting to have some success. I mean, Trump entered office talking almost exclusively about ending this war. He even has these tomahawks couched in terms of he's trying to bring the war to an end. And yet, really just before we came on the air here, it was announced that Zelensky, after the two phone calls that he had with Trump in back-to-back days, is now going to come to Washington, D.C. in person this Friday. So far, no announcement on exactly what they're going to talk about. But since he's really hard asking for both air defense and Patriot missiles, I'm sorry, and the Tomahawk missiles, one wonders if one or both of those are going to be on the table for Zelensky. Now, I want to go back to what Zelensky was talking about at that meeting, because you mentioned that he's trying to encourage them and they don't need a lot of encouragement. He did here, too, by providing some evidence that a lot of people cite Emmanuel Macron about a month ago that I think you and I have already talked about. But he brings it back up against here. And Zelensky says, look, Russia hadn't hardly taken any ground at all.
Russia has failed many times to carry out Putin's order to take Donbas. They keep delaying this senseless goal. In summer, they told the United States of America and others they would achieve it in a few months, by October or November. Instead, it is our troops who are pushing forward now. Our results are possible because we no longer face the big shortages of regular weapons we had before. Some items are still missing, but we are working hard to ramp up our industry so it can supply more. I want to stress we are steadily increasing production of our own weapons. More than 40% of the weapons on the front now are made in Ukraine. But every package of military aid from your countries still matters.
So let's take the two pieces he said there. One is the issue of Russia hadn't gained much territory. And then the second one I thought was more surprising, that he claimed that we don't have a shortage of weapons now. But first of all, let's take a look at his claim that Russia has been trying for a long time to take the Donbas and they just can't do it. What do you make of that?
Well, first of all, again, the idea of measuring Russian success by measuring square meter is a wrong assumption. And for that, we have to remember what the Russian general Surovikin said in October 2022. And at that point, he said, the Russians, we are using a new strategy. That happened after you had several attempts to have a negotiation between Ukraine and Russia, and all these attempts failed due to the Europeans. And in September 2022, Ursula von der Leyen, in the State of the European Union, she said there will be no appeasement and no negotiation with Russia. And at that point, that, by the way, that triggered the decision of the Ukrainian Security Council to forbid any talk with Russia. And the same month, the Russians said, okay, that's fine. Then we don't, you don't want to talk. We don't talk anymore. We change our strategy. We are not trying to achieve any pressure to have a talk and negotiation. We'll destroy systematically your potential. And we don't, and he said, General Surovikin said, we are not making advance on the ground. We are waiting for the advancing enemy and to destroy it methodically. Meaning that the Russians do not have as an objective to gain territory. They are gaining territory just for the sake of reaching the enemy to destroy it, period. It's not the proper unit of measurement of the Russian success would be the number of casualties in Ukraine, but not the number of square meter. And that's exactly what Zelensky has not understood. The Russians don't aim at moving ahead, moving forward on the ground. They just want to kill people, if I can put it very bluntly. And Zelensky is, in fact, facilitating this, achieving this aim to the Russians by sending all its troops, and they are getting destroyed as they come to the front. And that's exactly what's happening. So and that's something that already Zaluzhny have identified, that was already identified in the Battle of Bakhmut, by the way. And but the Ukrainians had never managed to draw the consequence of this situation, have never changed to maneuver warfare, trying to avoid the enemy. And they have, on the contrary, they have tried to have some kind of position warfare. And the Russians have advanced. I mean, what we have seen today in Krasnoarmeysk and all these cities that we mention every day in our media, this simply because Ukraine has not understood that you can win a war even if you go backwards. It's not about territory. The aim is to destroy the forces. That's something that Clausewitz already said. And that's exactly the doctrine of the Russians. And by using maneuver warfare, that's exactly, for instance, what the Russians have done in Kherson in October 2022 and in Kharkov, in the Kharkov region in September 2022. When the Ukrainians counterattacked there, the Russians could anticipate that movement, and they withdrew even before being in contact with the Ukrainians. So the Ukrainians came into an empty area. They were bombed by the Russian artillery. The Russians could withdraw in good order without having contact with the enemy. And that's exactly the way you win this kind of war. And but the Russians have been expert in this kind of things. When the enemy is too strong for in front of you, instead of trying to struggle against an enemy which is superior in force, you just withdraw, you leave an empty space. The Ukrainian enter the space, you destroy them with artillery, aircraft, flying bombs, and whatever, and then you save the troop, the life of your own troops. And that's, if you look carefully at what has happening since 2023, I mean, in fact, October 2022, if we are serious, we look at all that, the Russians have been consistently doing that, thus killing Ukrainians for nothing, basically.
Yeah. So what do you make about the second part of his claim there, which I found surprising, that he actually said, yeah, we don't have a shortage of weapons and ammunition anymore. We can still use some air defense missiles, but we're pretty good on the rest. Do you think that's accurate? And if not,
no, I think it's not. I think he's lying. But to understand that, we have to understand that Zelensky is sitting between two chairs. On the one hand, he has to portray the Russian as weak as possible in order not to discourage the support of the Europeans. And at the same time, he has to show that the Russians are still a threat to Europe, not simply to Ukraine, but also to Europe, because so that motivates the Europeans. Because in here in Europe, that's very interesting. A lot of people are scared about the possible Russian invasion. I mean, I know a lot of people who tell me, well, I'm scared about Putin because he may attack us. Where do they take that from? I mean, obviously from the media, but you know, there is no objective information that can confirm the idea that A, the Russians want to attack Europe, B, that they have the enough resources to attack Europe, and C, that what the objective they want to achieve. What for? You know, the Europeans, I mean, the Westerners at large, have been used to wage war without an objective. Yes, right. But that's the reality.
No, that's a good point. I hadn't thought of it like that.
Yeah, no, that's exactly that. I mean, that's exactly why we lose our wars, because we don't know what we want to achieve. I mean, I know several officers that I knew in the NATO, and some of them ended in, they have not ended, but they were engaged in the Operation Barkhane in the North Africa, in Mali and Niger against terrorists. And when they came back, I had the opportunity to talk and to have some kind of, not a debriefing, but let's say, a discussion about what they experienced. But I said, well, the main problem we have is that we don't know what we want to achieve. They kill people, and they are very effective in killing people, but they don't solve the problem. Because, and all of them told me, when we are engaged in Mali or Niger, we kill one, you have 10 more that come up. Meaning that
the exact same experience in Afghanistan and Iraq. I observed it myself.
This is exactly that. You know, when I was in Afghanistan, people told me exactly the same thing. There is no objective. They don't know what they want to achieve. And we are used to that. We go in places and it's easy because we have superior firepower. So it's very easy to go and just fire around and that's it. But what are you achieving? You are not solving the problem. You are not. And you mentioned Afghanistan. In Afghanistan, what happened? The government that the U.S. put in place lost how many? 48 hours before being changed. So, you know, even the Russians, when they left in 1989, they managed to, they put in place a government, and this government lasts for 2 years. The Americans, when they left Afghanistan, the government they had put in place lasted just 48 hours.
Right.
So, yeah, but that means that the Russians knew exactly why they were fighting for, and the purpose of their presence. And they used the time. I mean, obviously, I was in intelligence at that time. I received all the report every day, and I was in touch with Ahmed Shah Massoud in the Afghan resistance. So I have followed this conflict very closely. But we noticed that the Russians, besides what happened in the valleys and all that, all the battles and things like this, besides this, you had a political work that was being done in Kabul, and an administration was put in place, and political, you had a whole setting. A state was functioning there, probably not the way you would prefer in Switzerland or in the United States, but that was a functioning government. And when they left, they just withdrew, and they went back to the Soviet Union. By the way, when they went, it was done in a very festive way. I mean, you had parade and all that. It was not just a withdrawal with people trying to grip the airplanes and all that. That was not like this. They went in good order. All the tanks, flags were in the air and all that. So yeah, they even made a medal for those who left Afghanistan on that day. So this was done in a very orderly way. and the government remained in place for 2 years. What happened in Afghanistan after the Westerners left, 2 days and everything was lost. And all the equipment today is parading on Bagram Air Base, it's manned by the Taliban, you know. So meaning that the problem is that we are used in the West to fight wars without objectives.
And therefore, and, you know, I'm sorry, I'm running a little bit short on time here. I don't want to miss this one here because there's another, I think, really negative proclivity on the Western side, and that is to overestimate what we can get done and underestimate what Russia can do on the other side. And one other thing that Zelensky mentioned here today was that he actually, I'm not making this up, you'll see it now, he equated pressuring Putin with success the same way Trump pressured Hamas for success.
Russia's war in Europe remains the biggest source of global instability, and it depends on all of you whether this war will end too. Putin can be forced into peace, just like any other terrorist. Even Hamas is now preparing to release hostages. If that is possible, then Putin can also be forced to restore peace.
So stands to reason, if Hamas can be forced into giving up hostages, then Vladimir Putin can be forced to giving up stuff to Ukraine. What do you make of that?
Well, first of all, he had the opportunity to talk to the Russians because he talked to them in March 2022. And he was the one who broke the talks. So he's a perfect idiot. In fact, there were three occasions in which Zelensky himself asked to have a dialogue with Russians. That was on the 25th of February 2022, 1 day after the beginning of the special military operation. Zelensky called the Swiss foreign minister and asked to organize a peace conference. That started the process in Gomel. The conference never happened, but you had talks in Gomel at the Belarus border. That was on the request of Ukraine. But eventually what happened? Those negotiators, those who negotiated on the Ukrainian side, were killed by the SBU. And even agent of the military intelligence, the GUR, were killed by agent of the SBU, the security service, because they were negotiating with the Russians. And this is not my invention. That was said by, but you can read my book. It's written in my book on covert wars in Ukraine. And that was said by Kirill Budanov. He said that in the media, in the Ukrainian media.
Really?
That was said, and he explained very clearly that Kireyev, I may be wrong with the name, but I think the negotiator was Kireyev. He was an agent of the GUR. He was assassinated by the SBU. And the first negotiation round stopped in January. Now, 3 weeks later, Zelensky came back with the talks in Ukraine. That was already also at the request of Ukraine, and that happened. And you know that it was short-circuited by Boris Johnson, the Europeans. I mean, okay, we have discussed that already. Yeah. And then you had a third occasion, and that was when Erdogan visited Zelensky in Lviv, I think, in August 2022. And on that occasion, Erdogan proposed a summit between Zelensky and Putin. And Zelensky, in fact, agreed to this summit. Putin was not immediately enthusiastic about it, but eventually, the same day, that was the 18th of August 2022, Putin accepted to have a meeting with Zelensky. And once again, Boris Johnson came and said, no flimsy agreement with the Russians, And the whole thing stopped. And then happened what I said before. This was the stop about any negotiation with the Russians. But Zelensky had three opportunities to talk to the Russians. Why did he stop that? Why didn't he say to the Europeans, I want to talk to the European, to the Russians? Because in fact, he traded peace and peace talks against money. And that's exactly what he's asking for today. Money. That's exactly what drives Zelensky is money. And that's why I think this is something extremely disturbing to hear what he says, because he had the opportunity, he missed the he renounced the opportunity deliberately. And today he's crying for that. I mean, this is just insane. And and in addition to that, I think he's exaggerated the potential of his ability. Now, for just open a parenthesis about the comparison with Hamas. Hamas started its operation on the 7th of October to protect, in fact, the population, because the whole issue was the dialogue that was broken by Israeli government about the prisoners, because you had prisoners and you had talks in 2022, and the Netanyahu government stopped brutally this discussion. And it's in order to resume the discussion that Hamas made this attack in order to take, you can call them hostages. I think I took them prisoners of war because they were all people who were occupying force for Gaza. The Gaza division is essentially by international law a force that is in charge of occupying Gaza. I mean, even if it's from the outside, it's still legally an occupation. And what the Hamas did was to take some people to resume the negotiation about the prisoners. So the Hamas started the whole attack and the whole process, in fact, in order to negotiate about its own Palestinians, about the population, the Palestinian population. Now, it's exactly the same reason for the Russians to attack Ukraine. The Russians attacked Ukraine when the Ukrainians started to attack the Donbas population. And that's what prompted this preemptive attack, we can say, even if it was not exactly preemptive, because the Ukrainians had already started to attack the Donbass population. That this is confirmed by OSCE observers. Yeah. This has been documented quite widely. So you can compare the two. Of course, the name terrorist is a little bit scary, but note that only Western countries consider Hamas as a terrorist, and the UN does not consider the Hamas as terrorist. Consider that. But beyond this, the motivation and the rationale for the Hamas on one hand and for the Russians on the other hand is very similar, because they feel their action as existential. Now, the Israelis and the Ukrainians are in the same situation. They were the ones who tried to oppress a population on both sides. I mean, legally, everything that Israel is doing to the Gaza population and was doing prior to the 7th of October was basically an oppression, because they have absolutely no reason to do that. Gaza should not be an occupied territory. It should be, as the UN and the International Court of Justice has ruled, it is a Palestinian territory, and where the Palestinians should have an independent, a sovereign authority, period. And Israel doesn't want this. And this is exactly what the Ukrainians on their side were doing to the Donbas population. So there is a lot of similarities in the two, if we compare that way. But we don't want to go into many details, because obviously these are not the same conflicts.
Right, right, right. And then it also breaks down with the power of the Hamas or the Russian side. Then it gets way
well. That's
out
the difference, exactly. And that's right. And that's where the distinction is very important, because Russia has obviously a capacity of leverage over the Ukrainians, what Hamas has not really. I mean, the difference is probably made by what happened worldwide, this support, not to the Hamas, but the support to the Palestinians and to what the Palestinians have endured for all these years and what has become more apparent through the 7th of October, which, by the way, was probably also an objective to raise the issue of the Palestinian issue to expose that to the world. And that was definitely achieved. But again, we cannot compare one-to-one those conflicts. They are not exactly the same, and there are a lot of differences and all that. But the situation is very similar to some extent. And when Zelensky said that you can pressure Russia, this is discounting the fact that Russia is more powerful than Ukraine, and is probably even more powerful than the whole of Europe.
Right. And that does make the difference. Listen, I'm afraid I'm going to have to leave it there for right now. It's fascinating idea, though, about at least the similarities between the Hamas side in Israel and the Russian side in the Ukrainians. We're going to go into that in more detail next time you get on. I think that's a fascinating idea. But thank you very much for bringing up all these issues today and just laying it out there the way it really is and about the hard power politics. Thank you so much for coming on.
No problem. Thank you. Bye-bye.
And we appreciate you guys, too. Be sure and like and subscribe if you haven't. And by the way, speaking of the Middle East, we are going to talk about that this afternoon at 2:30 p.m. Joy in the Middle East. We're at least for this time, we're going to look at the happiness on both sides about getting their prisoners and hostages back. We'll take a look at some other things as well. But at least this one day, there is something to be happy about in the Middle East. We'll see you this afternoon at 2:30 p.m. on the Daniel Davis Deep Dive.